天之天，地不能地，地三千国之王，地老总之公，王尊尊者吧。在南北上都各者，大三千南北都是自主，今天老之所，这老之所，今天老之所，老之不在，今天老之所，除非有谁自召，今天老之。Now, please think to yourself that it is for the sake of all of our mothers, all sentient beings who are as limitless as space, that we must achieve the state of complete and perfect Buddhahood. In order to do this, we need to practice the Dharma. In order to practice the Dharma, we need to know what to practice, so we engage in listening and contemplation. So please think to yourself that this is the reason why we are having this class on the way of the Bodhisattva this afternoon. It's the Dharma that we are discussing, the way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva. The great being Shantideva has three, the main part of the text has three sections, rejoicing in the benefits of bodhicitta, taking the Bodhisattva vow, and then keeping the Bodhisattva vow, guarding bodhicitta without it waning. Of these three sections, yesterday we spoke about the first, and starting yesterday afternoon, and today we have been speaking about the second, the taking the Bodhisattva vow. Taking the Bodhisattva vow consists of two parts. There's the seven branch prayer, and then there is actually taking the vow. So we are discussing the seven branch prayer at this point, or the seven branch practice, we could say. And this has, of course, eight branches if we count refuge. In this text, it's first offerings, prostrations, refuge, confession, and we have completed those four. So we have now come to the fifth of the seven branches, or the fourth of the seven branches, if you don't count refuge separately, which is rejoicing, and this is the beginning of the third chapter, the way of the Bodhisattva. I want to just comment, I'm very happy to see these lovely and abundant offerings today. And I have to say, actually makes me very glad to see is that we are having abundant offerings that we can also tell were done by people from New England. Because there are these beautiful squashes and chards and things along all the flowers. It's like, this is like, oh, it's so perfect. I walked in this morning and I saw it. It's like, we're definitely in New England. So this, you know, this is great. So rejoicing. Rejoicing is both easy and difficult. Because rejoicing is something that should be very easy, because all you have to do is, you know, we can rejoice with our bodies, we can rejoice with our speech, and we can rejoice with our minds. Rejoicing with our bodies means that, like, we start getting, you see something that you're really rejoicing in, you start feeling excited, you can get goosebumps, you might start crying or whatever. That's rejoicing with your body. Rejoicing with your speech is like saying, well done, wonderful, great, that's excellent. That's rejoicing with your body. And rejoicing with your mind is when you see someone else has done something virtuous, something good. Then you think, that was good. That was an excellent thing to do. Well done. You're thinking this to yourself, and you appreciate the good things that people do. And this can be from anything small to big, whatever size. It doesn't really, you know, we can rejoice in any size virtuous act. There's no virtuous act that is too small to do, and there is no virtuous act that is too small to rejoice in. So you see someone, you're walking down the street, and someone in front of you puts a coin in a panhandler's, or someone actually in Portland, it's the people down at the intersection with Deering Avenue standing out there. So if someone in the car in front of you puts something in the veteran's cup, you can rejoice, right? And This is all, you know, doing things, you're rejoicing at that, rejoicing at anything. So when you see someone doing something good in particular, so you can, but you can also rejoice when something gets someone good. When your neighbor wins the lottery, when someone else has something good happen to them, we can rejoice in both the cause, which is rejoicing in the good act, and rejoicing in the result, which is getting something good. So someone meets someone and falls in love, we can rejoice in this, you know. Whether or not it's, you know, something, you know, a monk would do is a different matter. But, you know, when people are happy, we can rejoice in this. When they suddenly come by wealth, or they get a promotion, something they're happy about. Maybe if they're a promotion, we can say, well, I'm glad you're happy, but I'm glad I don't have that promotion, whatever. At any rate, we can rejoice in both the results and in the causes, which are the actions. And when you rejoice in the causes, it's said that you gain merit equal to the merit of the person who has done the virtuous action. So when you see someone giving and making a wonderful offering like this, and then you rejoice in this, it's like, wow, this is really good. You get the same offer, merit, as the people making the offering. And when we, the other thing, just this is an aside, when we all participate together, you know, one person brought one bouquet of flowers, one person brought the delicata squash, one person brought the, you know, the chard, and we put it all together and make this great offering, we all get the merit of the entire offering, because we're doing it together. So, and then people who didn't participate in the offering, who rejoice in it, get the merit of the entire offering too. So it's a really wonderful way to sort of train your mind in this. Now, sometimes people do psychologically have difficulty with rejoicing. Some people are just, they see someone and maybe someone they don't like or they don't approve of getting something good, and they have trouble rejoicing in that. So it's important to try to rejoice, you know. Jealousy or envy, so rejoicing is the opposite of jealousy or envy, and it's the antidote for rejoicing and envy. So when you see someone else receive something good or do something good, it's important to try to rejoice in this as much as you can. Now, you might not at the beginning be able to rejoice for everyone, but you should try. You should really try as hard as you can to rejoice whenever you see someone getting something good. Even with people like Paul LePage, you know, or Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, when you see them getting good things that they're happy about. Even people that we think of as being villains, you know, we can still rejoice when good things happen for them. We should. I mean, actually, in the text, we rejoice for the merit that all sentient beings have done. So if we can't rejoice in the merit that people we don't like do, how can we rejoice in the merit of all sentient beings? We've automatically divided. If you only rejoice in the merit of good sentient beings and don't rejoice in the merits of people you judge to be bad sentient beings, you're not rejoicing in the merit of all sentient beings. You're taking a partial set. And it's kind of contrary to the Bodhisattva spirit, and probably quite possibly contrary to the Bodhisattva vow. So it's important to do as much as we can to actually rejoice in all the merit of all sentient beings. So it takes a little practice, a little bit hard, but generally it's what prevents us from rejoicing is envy or jealousy. So when you find yourself getting envy or jealous, you know, it doesn't, When you see someone who seems to be undeserving, someone who is a big crook, then ends up doing well, some businessman who's completely unscrupulous, or some businesswoman who's completely unscrupulous, someone who really treats people terribly, and yet they get to be fantastically wealthy through their business, you know, which they're running unscrupulously, you can still rejoice in them being prosperous. The prosperity in Buddhist terms, there are a lot of causes and conditions that go into prosperity, but it's said that generosity is the main cause of prosperity. So the generosity in some past life put them in a position where they could become prosperous and wealthy in this life. So you can say, well, okay, the conditions that led to their prosperity in this life, you know, the unscrupulous dealings and so forth, may not be worthy of celebration, but the fact that they're prosperous, that they have enough food, and that they have enough clothing, that they aren't suffering the deprivation of poverty and so forth, is worth celebrating. That did come from a virtuous cause in the past, a virtuous cause with a few unvirtuous conditions mixed in, making a defiled result in this lifetime. But it is still a result where there's one person there who is not suffering from hunger right now. At the same time, you can, you know, when you have something like that, you can mix your rejoicing in that with a little bit of compassion and an aspiration that all of their negative actions, all, you know, any of the unscrupulous activities that they've done that get to them to that position that you feel kind of envious of, you can make the aspiration that all of the negative results, all the painful results of their negative actions ripen on you in the future, so that they may be free of them. This is part of the mind training practice. So you're speaking about this in the Monday evening groups, and it's kind of a backwards way of thinking about it according to how we normally think about it. But generally thinking, take all the loss upon yourself, give all the victory to others. It's a very profound thing to do. And if you have problems with envy, a good one to try, a good one to work out. So consider, if you have difficulties with that, consider working more with the teachings on the 7 points of mind training as taught by Trungpa Rinpoche in The Heart of the Dharma and many other books. So that's the general text, presentation on rejoicing. And so the text begins rejoicing basically for all of the different types there's one more thing that I left out that's mentioned in the commentary. I've got my note here that's reminding me. So the result of rejoicing is actually greater than the actual act that you're rejoicing for. There is the story of King Prasenajit, the king of the land of Shravasti, who invited the Buddha to come for lunch every day for a week. And at the end of the meal, it was the custom for the Buddha to single out the person who had done and thank the person who had done the greatest merit of that day, making the offering. So King Prasenajit put out a huge meal for the Buddha and 500 monks. And, you know, some of the townspeople also came. They didn't get to eat until after all the monks were done, but they came to watch the meal and then receive the teachings that the Buddha would give at the end. And so King Prasenajit prepared beautiful food and with his own hands served the Buddha and the other monks. A king serving, you know, it's like a king doing this with his own hands, and felt very good about himself, saying, oh, this is, I'm earning a lot of merit. This is very good. The Buddha is going to mention me at the end. And then all the people, and there was this little old beggar woman sitting in the back saying, oh, this is so good what the king is doing. I really rejoice in what the king is doing. The king is there. And so at the end of the meal, the Buddha asks the king, who shall I make the dedication to? Shall I make it to you, or shall I make it to the person who has gained the most merit? And the Buddha says, and then the king says, oh, you should make it to the person who has given the most merit, or had made the most merit. And so, well then, okay, I dedicate it to this little old woman in the back who's been rejoicing. And the king is kind of fuming. Second day, next day, the same. The third day, exactly the same. I could repeat the whole thing again, but I'm not going to, in the interest of time. Fourth day, the same. The fifth day, the same. The sixth day, the same. By the seventh day, the king is like frantic. How am I going to get her to do this? He's talking about it with his ministers. What are we going to do? The minister said, well, we'll take care of it, king. We'll go and we'll make sure that she's so distracted that there's no way she can possibly rejoice. So the king is there, he's serving the meal, and the ministers are back there giving the lady a hard time, saying, what are you doing? You don't have any right here. You move over there. You do this. No, you can't sit there. So she's getting flustered. You know, these ministers are giving a hard time, and she's forgetting to rejoice in the Buddha's in the king's merit. And so at the end of the meal, the Buddha says, as usual, who would you like me to dedicate to this to yourself or the person who's gained the most merit? And the king says, oh, please dedicate it to whoever gained the most merit. And the Buddha said, okay, it's you today. It's like, I don't know what he's saying. Yes, it was me. I don't know. But it's like that. So that's just showing that the Buddha considered the merit of rejoicing to be greater often than the act that led to it. Because when you're rejoicing, you have to rejoice with a pure heart. And King Prasenajit, when he was making those offerings, he actually all along had this little thought in his mind, I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it. I'm doing something good. And the woman in the back, she was just completely no conception of self. It's like, oh, wonderful. This is why rejoicing is such a beautiful, beautiful thing to do. So the text begins, I rejoice delighted in the virtues of beings that relieve the agonies of the lower realms and make the suffering happy. I celebrate the virtues gathered that cause enlightenment. I rejoice in beings' emancipation from the suffering of samsara and in the protector's Buddhahood and in bodhisattvahood. I rejoice gladly in the ocean of bodhicitta that brings all sentient beings to happiness and gives them benefit. So the first one, is rejoicing in what we call the precursors to liberation. The precursors to merit. Precursors to merit means those virtuous feelings that we have that lead to prosperity in the high realm. So it's like the virtue that we do that we dedicate that will lead to being prosperous in this life, being happy and comfortable, or be taking rebirth in the realms of the gods. So this is in the so these are the actions that will take someone who's in the lower realms and brings them up to the higher realm. So someone was asking me about, well, what about animals who have so little opportunity to accumulate merit? So when animals do kind things for one another, or when they do kind things for humans, and especially like we have tales about dogs who will rescue people, but other animals also can do kind things, that sort of action. But also the actions of humans, and then the results. The result of being relieved of the agonies of the lower realms and made happy. The next two lines refer to what are called the precursors to liberation. These are the acts that we do on the paths of accumulation and on the path of joining. So the paths, they aren't really noble paths yet, but they lead us to the liberation from samsara. So this would be gathering the accumulation of merit through the practice of generosity and so forth, meditation that we do as ordinary individuals and so forth. This will take us eventually to liberation, and so we call them the precursors of liberation. The third verse, I rejoice in the being's emancipation from the sufferings of samsara. This refers to the liberation that people who follow the path of the foundation vehicle and achieve the status of arhat and so forth receive. And in the protector's Buddhahood and in bodhisattvahood, that's rejoicing in the results of the Mahayana path. So I rejoice gladly in the ocean of bodhicitta that brings all sentient beings to happiness and gives them benefit. And so this is rejoicing in the cause of the Mahayana, or the cause of the Mahayana results, which is the practice of bodhicitta, the motivation and the practice of bodhicitta. So with that, we've covered the rejoicing. The next section is section on requesting the Buddhas to turn the wheel of Dharma. And the reason for this section is you might think that, well, the Buddhas want to do everything they can to help all sentient beings. So, of course, the Buddhas are going to turn the wheel of Dharma. So turning the wheel of Dharma is sort of Dharma speak for saying, teach the Dharma. The Buddha's turning the wheel of the Dharma means the Buddha's teaching the Dharma. And but the Buddhas don't necessarily, once they achieve enlightenment, they don't necessarily immediately teach the Dharma. And there are several reasons for this. The first is that they might be in a world realm where it's not quite right for them to teach the Dharma yet. The other reason, like with the Buddha Shakyamuni, is as to that he, on the one hand, he wasn't certain that other beings would be able to immediately understand it. On the other hand, it was to make people realize how rare it is to teach the Dharma. It's incredibly precious and rare for someone to teach the Dharma. There are said to be Buddhas who, after they achieve enlightenment, won't teach the Dharma until the very last day before they pass into nirvana. There are Buddhas who wait years before they teach the Dharma. Our teacher, the perfect Buddha, awoke to Buddhahood under the Bodhi tree on the full moon day of the Vaishakha month, that's usually in May, and spent 49 days under the Bodhi tree without teaching the Dharma. He said to himself, according to the sutras, "Deep peace, unelaborate, luminous, non-compound, like nectar it is this Dharma I've found. Whomever I should teach it would not understand it, and so I shall stay unspeaking in this wood, or so I shall stay in this wood without speaking." And so he stayed in the under the Bodhi tree and in the areas around. And if you go to Bodh Gaya, you can see the different places where he sat, where he paced back and forth, the place where he sat for a week looking at the Bodhi tree without blinking, and so forth. You can see all of these different spots, but you don't see a spot there where he taught the Dharma. It wasn't until the gods Brahma and Indra came and made offerings to him and said, "Please teach the Dharma," that he then went to Sarnath and met his first five disciples and taught them the Dharma. And so this is the reason he didn't immediately teach, was to make us realize how precious it is for the Buddhists to teach the Dharma. So it's like, we have to do ourselves what Brahma and Indra did. Now, we don't have a Buddha Shakyamuni right in front of us right now, but what we can do when we make this supplication to Buddhas to please teach the Dharma, we make the supplication to all of the Buddhas in all of the realms throughout all possible universes, please teach the Dharma now. And so by making this, we gather a lot of merit by asking them to please teach. You're just sitting there waiting. Is he going to teach or not? Mm-hmm. No. You have to actually ask, please teach. So you request the teacher to come. You request them to give you the teachings. And so this is in this next verse. "With my palms joined, I implore the Buddhas in all directions light the lamp of Dharma in the gloom of sentient beings' woes." So that's the fifth branch, the request to turn the wheel of Dharma. The next branch is the request for the Buddhas not to pass to nirvana. All right. My notes are sometimes a little illegible, so I've figured out my note. So the next one is the request to turn the Buddha to not pass into nirvana. The Buddha, when he came to the end of his life, he said three times to his to Ananda, who was his cousin or nephew, I think nephew. And he said to him, the Buddha, because of his mastery over the 4 feet of miracles, could remain as long as his disciples ask. And Ananda didn't say anything. And then the Buddha, a little while later, said to Ananda, the Buddha, with his mastery over the 4 feet of miracles, could remain as long as his disciples ask him to. And Ananda again did not say anything. And then a third time, the Buddha, he's dropping big hints. the Buddha, with his mastery over the 4 feet of miracles, could remain in this world realm without passing away as long as his disciples ask, and Ananda did not ask him to. So the Buddha was kept traveling, and then he was served. The blacksmith Chunda served him a meal that turned out it had food poisoning. The Buddha didn't let anyone else eat it. The blacksmith did not know this at all either. He certainly did not intend to harm the Buddha in any way. It was infected with some, I don't know, botulism or something. The Buddha would not let anyone else eat it. He ate it, and he got terribly sick. And then the blacksmith said, "Please, Buddha, do not pass into nirvana." But the Buddha said, "Now it's time for the Buddha to pass away. But since you have asked, I will remain for an additional 2.5 months." And so he still lived for another 2.5 months after that, before he actually passed away in Kushinagara in northern India. So it's important for us to ask the Buddhas, please remain in this world realm. We shouldn't do what Ananda did. This is one of Ananda's big mistakes. We won't go into the rest of that. It's too much. So for that reason, we make this request to the Buddhas to not pass away to nirvana. Joining my palms, I beseech the victors who wish to pass to nirvana. Don't leave these wanderers in blindness. Please stay for countless eons. So we're asking the Buddhas to stay, and to stay for eons at a time, to teach the Dharma to all sentient beings. So that completes the six of the seven branches. So the seventh of the seven branches is dedication. When you dedicate merit, I spoke about it a little bit on the first day, so I'm not going to repeat too much about it. It's more or less what I said on Friday evening. There is a sutra where it describes that virtues, it's like if you have a drop of water. If you have a single drop of water, that drop of water can dry up, evaporate very quickly. But if you have a whole ocean, if you take that single drop of water and you drop it in the ocean, then that water will not dry up until the entire ocean has dried up. Similarly, if we take our merit and we dedicate it, then it's like dropping that water in the ocean. Until we have achieved enlightenment, that merit will never be depleted. So we imagine that we're dedicating all of our virtue to the benefit of all sentient beings. So this is a very important practice. I think actually, to step back from the traditional way of looking at it, if we think about psychologically what's happening, when you do your meditation practice, sometimes you feel a little bit rushed. And you get to the end of the practice, and you say, okay, I'm done. And you get up and you go. Sometimes you're so distracted you just get up and go before you even really, you're putting things away and leaving before things are done. What is happening in your mind at that point? It's like everything you have just tried to do in your meditation practice or whatever is just like gone. It's like you haven't really taken the time to really let it settle in. So instead, when you do the practice and you take the time to think, I'm taking all this merit as a representative of all the merit that I've ever done in this life or any other lifetime, and all the merit that any sentient being has ever done in the past, is doing in the present, or will do in the future, I am dedicating this all to complete and perfect enlightenment. So the one virtue, the one merit, virtuous thing that we're doing, that half an hour of semi-distracted meditation, however paltry the merit may be, we're taking that as an example to illustrate any possible merit that anyone could do in any three times in any realm in the universe and dedicate it all to enlightenment. So you take that, and it's like it gives you a chance psychologically to let it sit in, sink in, before you actually do it. You know, if you do an exercise, you're exercising, working really hard, getting sweaty, doing the exercise, and what do you do at the end? You warm down. You take a minute or two. You're on the treadmill. I'm starting to exercise this year. This is how I know these things now. I didn't know last year. If you're on a treadmill, that you know, and you press the button to tell you to stop, then it goes gradually slower and slower and slower, so that you gradually slow down your heart rate. You get more benefit out of the exercise. Likewise, when we take the time to dedicate the merit and to really think about it, instead of just doing, sometimes you go to the monasteries and the nunneries, and it's like the dedication is time to put everything away and then be ready to get up immediately. So that as soon as the dedication is done, you've gone, which is not the best thing to always follow. Actually, I like the way, I much prefer the dedications in Dharma centers abroad, where everyone is actually paying attention and no one puts anything away until after the dedications are done. This is very, very good. It gives you time to actually think about things. Now, sometimes we recite the dedications in Tibetan, but if you usually the one we usually do, the Sunam Di Thamje Zigbanyi, this one is very short and you can learn it in English, and you can even sometimes say it in English, and I won't mind. So dedications are very important. So here we have a great number of dedications that we go through here, and they're relatively simple to understand. I think we just think about the meaning of the words. At least I hope they're simple to understand. You may tell me otherwise later. May the virtue that I have amassed by doing all of this, that is, by doing all of the seven branches, eliminate all the suffering of every sentient being. So this is a general dedication. As long as sentient beings are ill, until their ailments are cured, may be their medicine and doctor, may I be their nurse as well. So may I be able to free all sentient beings. I'm dedicating this merit, my own merit, and all, from doing the seven branches, and the merit of all beings' activity in virtue in the past, present, and future. I dedicate it so that I can free all sentient beings from illness. May showers of food and drink relieve the torments of hunger and thirst. In intermediate eons of famine, may I become food and drink. So this is in on one level, this is a prayer for all people who are hungry and thirsty now, people who are poor, deprived in places where there are famines and so forth in this world now, and in the other realms, such as the hungry ghosts. This is also it's set at the end of an eon. When the world comes to an end, there will be eras where there are famine, eras of plague, famine, and war, and so forth. And so this is in particular for those beings of the intermediate eons of famine, when people cannot find enough to eat. May I be an inexhaustible treasure for poor and deprived beings, and stay nearby them as the various things they need. And so this is an aspiration to dispel the deprivation and poverty of beings. To benefit all sentient beings, I give without hesitation my body, my belongings, and all virtues of the three times. So this is giving your body, your belongings, and everything, all virtues that you have done in the past, present, and future, the three times, for the benefit of all sentient beings. Now, in terms of giving your body, as it explains later in the Way of the Bodhisattva, until you are a level at a particular level, you can't actually give away your body while you're still alive, except for maybe kidney donation. Organ donation is an exception to this, but they didn't have organ donation at the time of Shantideva or of the Buddha. There are stories of the Buddha, like, you know, hacking a piece of flesh out of his hamstring and giving it to someone who wanted it. We aren't able to do that. You don't do that until you're ready to do it. So, but when we say that we're giving our bodies to all sentient beings, what we really mean is that we're giving our bodies over to the service of all sentient beings. So we're giving our bodies so we can use it to bring benefit of sentient beings, not benefit for ourselves, but for all other sentient beings. And so in this way, this is a dedication dedicating them as a cause of enlightenment. Nirvana's relinquishing everything. My wish is to gain nirvana. At some point, all must be relinquished. It's best to give it to beings. So this is saying why it's reasonable to dedicate everything. At some point, everything we have in this lifetime, we are going to leave behind, our body, all our belongings, and everything. We're going to leave it behind us at the time of death. We don't know when that'll happen. So it's better to give it all away to sentient beings now. But also, we'll also leave it all when we achieve the state of nirvana. Now, nirvana here doesn't mean the cessation of the listeners. It means the state of Buddhahood. When we achieve Buddhahood, then we'll have no more need of the things of our lives. We'll, of course, continue in the bodies that we have. We may continue to use some possessions, but we'll use them solely for the sake of sentient beings. As I have given this, given living beings this body for their pleasure, may they always do with it as they like. Let them kill, revile, or beat it. They may make my body a cause for sport or jest or snickering, but I have given them my body. Why bother holding it dear? So let them do whatever acts will not bring them any harm. So we're giving our sentient, our body, our belongings, and everything to sentient beings. So once we've done that, we no longer think of it as being mine. It's their body. It's for them. So let them do whatever they're going to do. They may treat me badly. They may beat me, revile me, make jokes of me, or whatever. But we've given them the body already. So why should we worry about it? It's theirs to use. As long as we just hope that they use it well. That they use it in a way that won't bring them any harm. But there's no reason for us to cling to our body as being our own. So, following this, there the aspiration that there are greater aspirations. May thinking of me never be meaningless for any. So, wish to always have a good connection with someone. So, if you take a look at the stanza as a whole, this is similar to the second to last stanza of the first chapter, where we talk about even grave events don't cause the bodhisattvas any harm; they cause virtue to flourish. When someone thinks of me and has a thought of anger or faith, may that be the cause of what fulfills their every benefit. So no matter what sort of a connection we make with sentient beings, may it only be of their benefit. May anyone who slanders me, any others who cause harm, and all who criticize me have the fortune to awaken. So this is an aspiration to bring happiness in return for any harm, or to give happiness in return for any harm that is caused to us. May I be a guardian of the defenseless, a leader of travelers, a boat or ship or even a bridge for those who wish to cross. So this is a wish to be anything that any sentient beings need. A lamp for those who need a lamp, a bed for those without. For all those beings who want a servant, may I become their slave. So the first line here, actually there are different variants in the Sanskrit texts. There, it's a lamp. The word lamp in Sanskrit is deepam. And there are some variants where it says dvipam, which means land instead of lamp. So Pao Tsula Trengwa reads this verse differently. He reads it as being, may I be land for those who want land. So like travelers on a ship, you're coming to the, you need to find the safety of land. So you may he be land for these sentient beings. For all those beings who want a servant, may I be their slave. May I be a wish-fulfilling jewel, fine vase, accomplished mantra, great medicine, wish-fulfilling tree, and bountiful cow for beings. So wish-fulfilling jewel is like the jewels that that kings in ancient India had, where they'd make whatever prayer they had, and they would be able to receive that prayer would be fulfilled. A fine vase refers to a vase filled with substances that you accomplish via mantra, and then once you have done that, then it is able to give you what you need. The great medicine refers to the medicine that heals everyone. The wish-fulfilling tree is the tree in the realm of the 33 that the gods go to, and anything they wish for comes from this. The bountiful cow. When we make the mandala offering, you hear about the bountiful cow that's on the western continent of Gaudiya. And this is the cow that is able to, like milking it brings everything that you need. So like earth and the other elements, like space, may always be the ground supporting in many ways the lives of sentient beings. So this is a wish to be able to help all sentient beings without making any effort. The earth, water, fire, air, and space allow us to do everything. They support our lives, everything that we do, without thinking of it in any way. So may we be able to be like the ground supporting all sentient beings without having to think or make any effort. Likewise and always, for all beings out to the edges of space, may I be, till all pass to nirvana, that which provides their living. So may I be that which gives sentient beings a livelihood. So that completes the seven-branch prayer. So what we've come to now is the next two verses are the actual text of the vows of aspiration and engaged bodhicitta. We are currently ordinary beings in samsara. We have been ordinary beings in samsara for an infinite number of lifetimes into the past. And unless we are liberated, unless we liberate ourselves, we will be sentient, ordinary sentient beings and experience all of the sufferings of samsara for an infinite number of lifetimes into the future. The Buddhas of the past, like us, they were also sentient beings who, because of ignorance, wandered in samsara for an infinite number of lifetimes. And yet the Buddha, the Shakyamuni Buddha, three novemdecillion lifetimes, eons ago, made the aspiration, may I become a Buddha like the previous Shakyamuni Buddha. At that time, we were also in samsara. The Buddha Shakyamuni made that aspiration, and we did not. That is the only difference between us and the Buddha Shakyamuni. Or the only difference, shall we say, that is the only reason that there is a difference between the two of, between us and the Buddha Shakyamuni. We had the same capability back then. If we had made such an aspiration, we also would have become Buddhas by now, but we did not. All of the Bodhisattvas of the path, who are on the path, those who have achieved the noble levels and they've transcended the sufferings of samsara, those who are on the levels of ordinary beings, the paths of accumulation and joining, who have made great progress down the path, the only difference between them and us is that they roused bodhicitta and we have not. So, just like the sugatas of the past, now we need to arouse the mind of bodhicitta. So just as the sugatas of the past aroused the mind of bodhicitta, that is, the sugatas of the past developed the aspirational bodhicitta, and just as they followed step by step the training of the bodhisattvas, just as they took the vow of engaged bodhicitta and then followed the practice of the six paramitas until they achieved Buddhahood. So this is our example. So too shall I, to benefit wanderers, arouse the mind of bodhicitta. So this is making the vow of aspirational bodhicitta. Having the aspiration, I shall achieve Buddhahood for the sake of all sentient beings, to benefit them, to bring them to the state of lasting happiness, which is the liberation and omniscience of Buddhahood. And so too shall I follow step by step the bodhisattva's training. These two lines are the vow of engaged bodhicitta. Because following the training step by step means going through the path of accumulation, which is gathering the vast accumulation of merit, then going through the path of joining, which is meditating in a conceptual way on emptiness, the nature of all things, and then achieving realization and following the path of the bodhisattva levels and practicing the paramitas until we achieve Buddhahood. So, in this way, these two stanzas are taking the vows of aspirational and engaged bodhicitta together. As I mentioned yesterday, in this tradition of Nagarjuna, which is the tradition that is most frequently used for giving the bodhisattva vows, you take the vows of aspirational and engaged bodhicitta together. Okay? So this is the actual vow. Now, once we have taken the vow of bodhicitta, then at that point, you have the vow, you have to know, well, what do I do now that I have the vow? And there's a lot of discussion. Of course, the rest of the way of the bodhisattva, from the fourth to the tenth chapter is all about what do you do to keep bodhicitta without violating it. And so that's next year. Sorry. But you do need to know a little bit about what you need to do in order to keep your bodhisattva vow. And there are many lists of precepts of bodhisattva, and there are different sutras that teach different precepts for the bodhisattva path. There are, the tradition of Asanga teaches the four black and white dharmas. There are teachings of the 18 root precepts of bodhicitta and so forth. And if you read the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, you can read about those. I'm not going to go into all of those today, partially for sake of time, but also because following, I don't know, when the Gyawan Karmapa has taught about this, what he's really stressed is that there is really one precept that you have to keep, and this is the most important precept. This is never give up on any sentient being. That is, if you keep that one precept, you will keep the bodhisattva vow. Never give up on any sentient being. The Tibetan is kind of ambiguous. The Tibetan, you could translate as never give up on sentient beings. So the question is, well, if you give up on one sentient being, does that mean that you've broken the bodhisattva vow? And we say it, when you translate it into English, as never give up on any sentient being, it makes it pretty clear. If you've given up on one sentient being, then that has, if the vow is to bring all sentient beings to the state of Buddhahood, then giving up on one sentient being is the same as giving up on the vow, because you're no longer giving up all. Infinity minus one may still be infinite, but it is not all. Infinity minus infinite is still all, is still a lot, but it is definitely not all. When you give up on one sentient being, what's going to stop you from dividing other sentient beings up into other groups, more groups? The problem is we're dividing people up into me and them. Me and mine and them. Those I like, those I don't like. It's this bias that creates the walls between ourselves and other sentient beings. So we really have to overcome that bias in every way that we, you know, in any way that we can. We have to try to make sure that when we do our practice, that we're doing it for the sake of all sentient beings, including the ones that we don't like. And perhaps because we need to include the ones especially that we don't like, we especially need to include them. We need to make sure that they're especially there. So often, like when we do Tonglen practice, what you do is you imagine that you've got your father and mother on either side of you, and in front of you there are all of your enemies, which sounds like a really dramatic word in English, more a dramatic word in English than in Tibetan or Sanskrit perhaps, but all of the people you don't like and who don't like you. You imagine that they're there. And when you do the Tonglen practice, do you all know what Tonglen is, more or less? It's a compassion practice. You do it for all sentient beings. You imagine that you're doing it for the people that you don't like, as well as everyone else. So you've got this big hilltop. You're on a hill. It's a big, broad hill. It's not, you know, if you're in like, you know, in like a Portland, not Portland, but if you're in New York City, in Manhattan, you know, you can't see anywhere because there are too many buildings in the way. So instead of being in a place like that, you're on a big, round hilltop, sort of like that hilltop in Topsom, Maine, but without any trees. Maybe a big Tibetan mountain. And all around you, you see all sentient beings all around you. And right to your side, your mother and father, and maybe your other relatives and friends to your side, and then everyone you don't like in front of you. All your enemies in front of you. And then you do the Tonglen practice of imagining that you're giving away all of your happiness and everything good that you have to all other sentient beings. As you breathe out, you imagine that it goes out in the form of white light, and when it strikes all those other sentient beings, they immediately become Buddhas. Then when you breathe in, you imagine that you're breathing in all of, including the enemies, they also become Buddhas. And then when you breathe in, you imagine that you're breathing in all of their misdeeds, all of their obscurations, everything you don't like about them, everything negative about them. You breathe it in, and as you do so, they're freed of all of their obscurations, and they become Buddhas. as you imagine. So every time you breathe out, they become Buddhas. Every time you breathe in, you imagine they become Buddhas. They're relieved of everything. And so you have to include everyone in this practice. Likewise, in our practice of the Bodhisattva vow, we need to make sure that we include everyone. The unfortunate thing is that we cannot help everyone right away. Even the Buddha couldn't help everyone right away. The Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, tried to kill the Buddha several times. First time, he got someone to roll a boulder down a mountain, and it struck the Buddha on his toe, but didn't kill him. The second time, he had a poison that he put on his fingernails. I guess he must have had long fingernails. He put this poison on his fingernails, and he went to the Buddha and said, "May I please massage your feet?" And the Buddha said yes. And he rubbed the Buddha's feet with his fingernails to get the poison onto the Buddha's skin, but it didn't work, and it didn't harm the Buddha at all, but he managed to get it on his own hands. And he, at that point, fell in great pain. It's said that the fires of hell opened up and swallowed him whole. I think that the poison must have been really one of these really agonizing deaths. That's probably why it's described like this, or maybe it really did happen like this. But as he died, he regretted what he'd done. And he still had to fall into hell and into the hells, but he regretted what he had done. And so it said that he will be reincarnated from the hell in a good realm and achieve enlightenment. So even the Buddha could not help anyone. There are people who saw the Buddha and yet, you know, didn't feel anything. There are people who meet the Dalai Lama and feel wonder, and there are people who meet the Dalai Lama and say, "Oh yeah, nice guy." So there are people who see Trungpa Rinpoche and, you know, don't particularly see anything, and people who meet him and are just overwhelmed. Then there are those of us who, you know, meet Rinpoche and aren't sure at first. He seems like a good teacher, but then we gradually get to know him and see more and more of his qualities. There are people like the Karmapa who is just, you know, like, and, you know, many people have a strong reaction to him, but there are people who don't. So you can never tell who are you going to be able to help or who you're not going to be able to help. Then there are going to be the people who actually do negative things to you, who challenge you, who are hard. There's just nothing that you can do to assuage them. And it might be that even that being in contact with them is a very difficult situation for you personally. So you may not be able to help that person. If you're in a position with someone, or you're in that conflict with someone, and you don't want to give up on that person, so what do you do? We try to get a little bit of distance. And if you're not in a position where you have to come together, if it's a coworker, it's difficult. But you can take a little bit of distance from that person if you have to. But when you take your distance from that person, you also have to think, though I may not be able to help this sentient being now, may not be able to help this person now, may I be able to bring this person to Buddhahood in the future. So it's important to make that aspiration. If you say, giving up on the sentient being is saying, even if this person is such a nincompoop that even if I have a chance, I'm never going to do anything to help them. Never. I'm finished. I've had it with them. If you've done that, you've broken the Bodhisattva vow. If you say, I can't handle this sentient being, I can't handle this person, this being right now, this great white shark, I'm going to get some distance from this great white shark, but please, may it become a cause of enlightenment, and that half of my arm that it ate, may that also be a cause of its enlightenment too. So that's what this means, not giving up on sentient beings. It doesn't mean that you don't get yourself out of situations you can't handle, because we are ordinary people, and if you find that you're in a position with someone where continuing to be in that will lead you to do something negative, it's better to get distance. Now, when you're in a position where you can't avoid that person, it's a difficult one, and I'm not sure I can give general advice on that, but it's most important. I think what often helps in a situation like that is when you really follow the teachings of mind training and think to yourself, the other person must be right. Let them have what they want. Now, there are also positions where you have to stand up for yourself. And the Karmapa does speak about this. There are times when something is going wrong and you have to stand up and you have to fix the situation. But when you do this, it is important that you do it in a manner that is not going to cause you to do anything wrong, nor to cause any problem for anything. And if people know that you're a Buddhist, to do it in a way that does not cause people to lose faith in Buddhism. For if we respond to anger with anger and break our bodhisattva vows, we're only going to give our enemies more cause for celebration, more fuel to the fire. For example, we can think of the events in Charlottesville, and there the Antifa... is that how you say the word? I haven't heard it spoken on TV because I don't watch TV. Antifascist protesters who... by many accounts, we're protecting the peaceful protesters, but they were being somewhat violent. Some of them were. I mean, I didn't really watch. I heard about it. I read about it, but I didn't watch. But there were some who did, you know, strike back, and so forth. Because they struck back and so forth, that gave the opportunity for supporters of the neo-Nazis and so forth to say, "Look, they're doing it too." So if you are completely nonviolent, no one has that chance to say that. And if you are in the situation, you know, where you stand up, but you do it in a nonviolent way, it doesn't mean that you necessarily give in all the time, but you always have compassion for the other being and always put sentient beings ahead of yourself. Never give up on sentient beings. Then this is important. So instead of doing it out of a sense of us and them, we're right, they're wrong, doing out of a sense of this is what is going to be most beneficial for sentient beings, and I'm going to stand up for what is most beneficial. Always with a sense of humility, because we are ordinary sentient beings and do not necessarily know ourselves. So that is the never giving up on sentient beings. So once we have taken the bodhisattva vow, then you've taken the bodhisattva vow. So this is the precept, the main precept to keep. And if you want to read about the others, you should look in the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. There are several translations of it out now. Take a look at the one in the Library of Tibetan Classics, Ken Holmes' translation that was translated there. It's a nice translation. Next thing we need to do is we need to make sure that once we have taken it, we need to make sure that it's going to increase and flourish. And in order to do that, you have to think to yourself, I've done something good. If you do something good and you think to yourself, I've done something good, then you're more likely to do it again. If you do something good and you say, maybe not, that wasn't so good, then you're not going to do it again. It's similar. It's like the opposite of our confession. In the confession, we look at what we've done bad, and we have remorse for it. So here, we look at what is done, what we've done that is good, and we celebrate it. We praise it, and by celebrating it, then we are able to then will increase and grow and flourish. And so the next several verses are about this. And so the first is taking delight for ourselves. And it begins with a section that where we feeling joy that we have done something that will benefit ourselves. As it says, once the intelligent have thus embraced sincerely bodhicitta, excuse me, they take delight in their resolve so that it may continue to grow. My life has become fruitful now. I've gained this human existence well. I've been born in the Buddha's family and have become the Buddha's child. So these two verses are talking about, the first is saying that giving the reason for celebrating and taking delight in bodhicitta, that it helps it to grow. The second is saying that now that we have taken the bodhisattva vow, we have become bodhisattvas. This means that we are new members, the new babies in the Buddha's family. So we're the Buddhist children. And because so we take delight in this. So this gives meaning to our human life. We've gained the human existence well. It means that not only have we had just a regular human existence, but this is a precious human existence with the leisures and resources that we're using for the benefit of beings. From now on, I shall always act in ways that befit my family, so as to bring no blemish on this stainless, venerable family. So now that we're members of the Buddhist family, we have to remember that we have to act in ways that live up to the Buddhist family. So act in ways that only benefit ourselves and all sentient beings, bring people further along the path to Buddhahood, so as to bring no blemish on, so not doing any wrongdoing that would cause any harm to ourselves or other sentient beings, or that would cause harm to the Buddhist teachings and Buddhism in general. Like a blind man who has discovered a jewel amidst a heap of garbage, somehow by a coincidence, bodhicitta has been born in me. So, if someone has, you know, a jewel, what do you do with a jewel? You have a really expensive jewel, what are you going to do? You're going to put it in the safe deposit box, right? You're going to take care of it. You're going to make sure that it's safe someplace, or you know, maybe you have a big safe in your home or something, but you have a really expensive, wonderful jewel, even better, a wish-fulfilling jewel. You have that, you're going to keep it safe so that no thief can come and steal it. So what are the chances of this jewel falling into a pit of garbage? Like, almost none. You know, the king has the wish-fulfilling jewel. It's wrapped up in silken cloths in this, you know, like, really complicated, beautiful wooden and metal casket that they take with many guards all the way, you know, from the palace to wherever they need the wish-fulfilling jewel. What's the chance that the wish-fulfilling jewel is going to fall out of this and into the garbage? Not great. But somehow it did. And not only did it fall into that, no one else saw it and picked it up. And then there's this blind man who's coming along. What's this? A blind man finds this jewel is like incredible. It's like this could hardly ever happen. So we, in the same way, you know, just the fact that we have become human is like billions to one, 40, 50 billion to one chance of becoming human, only if we figure the statistics based on animals and humans in this planet. And when you think about how many beings must there be in this universe and any other universe in all realms, just incredible numbers of beings. And so fortunate for us to come here and find this jewel of bodhicitta. Like, how could this happen? It's so extraordinary that we have this opportunity. And once we have this, once we have that, it's like it's so beneficial to have this chance. It's beneficial for ourselves, and it's beneficial for others as well. As it continues, the text continues, "This is the great elixir that vanquishes the Lord of Death. It is the inexhaustible treasure, the dispelling the poverty of beings." So it overcomes death. It overcomes all the different types of suffering, like death and poverty. The next verse, this is the supreme medicine that cures the maladies of the world, a resting tree for beings exhausted from the watering the peace of paths of existence. So it overcomes illness. It gives those who are exhausted, it gives them respite from the suffering of samsara. This is the universal bridge that frees all beings from the lower realms. And so in this way, it also dispels the sufferings of the lower realms. In other words, by teaching the Dharma, teaching people to practice virtue and give up non-virtue, you're teaching them to do the things that will lead them to happiness and that will prevent the sufferings from happening. If they're no longer performing the cause of death, the lower realms, and so forth, then they will not. The state of being free of death here is a reference to vanquishing the Lord of Death is another way of saying achieving the state of Buddhahood, because the Buddha is beyond being affected by death. Although Buddha continues to pass away in our perceptions. This is the rising moon of mind that soothes the torments of sentient beings' afflictions. So us having bodhicitta and teaching the Dharma will overcome all of the obscurations of the afflictions in other sentient beings. It's the great sun that brings an end to the darkness of beings' ignorance. So it overcomes not only the afflictive obscurations, but also the cognitive obscurations, the obscurations, the delusion of clinging to the apprehended object and the apprehending mind as being separate. It is the butter that emerges from churning the milk of true Dharma. So it is what really brings us the real benefit. For travelers roaming on the paths of existence, desiring to partake of happiness, the sublime blissfulness is close at hand to satisfy the supreme guest, sentient beings. Today, in the presence of all the protectors, I invite all sentient beings as my guests to Buddhahood until then happiness, God's demigods, and everyone rejoice. So, we're taking all sentient beings, all as numerous as they are, and we're saying, you are our guests. Please, we'll do everything. And we should be like, I've heard so much about Afghan hospitality. We should be like Afghanis welcoming guests into their homes. You know, giving everything, treating them well, being even better than Afghan hosts, bringing them not only the happiness, but also Buddhahood. So, and it says, to Buddhahood until then happiness. So there are guests, we're bringing them, we're going to bring you to Buddhahood, and until you achieve Buddhahood, we're going to bring you to all sorts of happiness, all freedom from suffering. So treating all sentient beings as our guest. This is a theme that recurs throughout the rest of the way of the Bodhisattva. It does recur. It's not. I don't know if it's a theme, but it's an image that does recur. The idea that we are now, as bodhisattvas, are like taking beings as our guests to Buddha. So this completes the third chapter, embracing citta from entering the way of the bodhisattvas. So what I'd like to do now is take a drink. What I'd like to do now is let's all recite this chapter together.